And welcome to another episode of the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. I'm AD Packham, and we are jingling your bells in association with allfootballshirts.com. Well, it's been another frustrating week here on Planet Albion as we return from our week on the road with just 1 point added to the total and having failed to bother the scorers. So our profligacy in front of goal continues to become a major concern as we gear up to face fellow strugglers Sheffield United on Sunday, where, if we fail to score again, we could face the very real prospect of spending Christmas Day in the bottom three for the first time since our return to the top flight. In other news, the Premier League has voted strongly in favour of permanent concussion substitutes, and it could be implemented as early as January. The number of subs has also been increased from 7 to 9, but only 3 can be used. Also this week, Polish starlet Jacob Moda will be joining up with the squad in January, having been recalled from his loan spell at Lech Poznan, and impressing for both them and for Poland. Joining me today is, of course, Alan Wares. We welcome back Jason Thackeray, and we are delighted to be joined by one of the country's most renowned sports writers and important voices in the industry. His words have provided a backdrop to some of the world's most important sporting events, and he's a former Football Writer of the Year, and he's currently Chief Football Writer for The Times. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Henry Winter.
Henry, hey guys, thanks for having me on.
Absolutely delighted to have you here on the Roar with us. It's a very, very busy time of the year. I mean, but how has lockdown been for you? Have you found it difficult? Have you been able to get out to many games?
I've done about 85 games behind closed doors, and they're rubbish. I think that if anyone needed reminding of the importance of fans, and we shouldn't do really, then this year has provided that. Look, obviously, there are bigger things going on. And I think Brighton, your club, and I talked to Graham Potter at the start of lockdown and Paul Barber, and you know, your club has been fantastic in lockdown, and particularly the supporters as well, you know, with the work with, was it the sort of Hove Food Bank and local food banks with the pay-per-view rebellion, which was marvellous. It's great to see fans unite from all clubs to throw out something as ridiculous as that. But I think Brighton have, you know, as a club, and I think in their communication, I think you're probably the best to communicate. I've done 3 games behind closed doors at Brighton, and I think you've got fans back. I think you're tier 2.
We're one of the few that have. There's only 4 teams left now.
We are tier 2.
Thank heavens for that, because honestly, even 2,000 fans, you go in, and I've done, I think, about 3 or 4 games with fans, 2,000 fans, and you go in there, you know, I've been to Arsenal and Chelsea before they went into tier 3, the stewards are smiling, there's more of a buzz around the press box. Of course, everyone's still socially distanced, but the most important thing is the players like it. And you talk to a player like Jack Grealish, who I've interviewed a couple of times in lockdown this year, and he says, listen, it's not simply about having the Holt End singing his name, it's about having the opposition fans giving him stick. He thrives on that. So it's a sort of, it's a two-way thing. So absolutely, I think if this year has shown anything, I mean, look, your club, I go to your ground, and I think architecturally, because it's all quite low and it's quite shallow, even though the rake is pretty good, I think actually this shouldn't generate so much noise, but it does. And that's a reflection on you. That's a reflection on, you know, that maybe the architecture, that's something I've missed out on. And that's the key thing I keep coming back to. Obviously, the brilliance of what the NHS have done, and, you know, everyone's admiration for them is huge. And the players and the fans and the clubs have supported the NHS. But really, it's games without fans are they're soulless. And I can't even for the rare occasion I watch a game at home, I cannot watch it with a fake crowd noise. Because I think it's cheating. I think we have to realise there's a pandemic going on. We have to realise that games without fans are terrible. It's been quite amusing. I've learnt a few new words from Kasper Schmeichel and Jordan Henderson behind closed doors.
Jurgen Klopp, actually.
yes, probably 5 subs. Yes. I think it's just reminded everyone of the importance of fans and the importance of podcasts like yours. The communication has been absolutely key. And I hope, and I've talked to the Premier League and to clubs individually about this, as we gradually step out of lockdown and as the vaccine kicks in, when fans return in numbers, which is, let's be honest, it's going to be next season, touch wood in the Euros with England, but it's going to be 5-6 months or so, then let's treat fans properly. Let's have a proper pricing structure for away fans. 20 is plenty, the Football Supporters Association. Mm-hmm. I've been banging on about it for years, getting bored saying it. Because what the fans don't do, and what you have to do, and this will be my only party political broadcast on behalf of the media, just fans, and I say this to all the fans I meet, you've got to be more militant. Look what you've done on pay-per-view. It's fantastic you talk about things. The forums are brilliant. But really, football fans need to take a stand more, like they do in Germany, over ticket prices, over moving around of kickoff times. Obviously, everything's scrambled at the moment because of COVID. We understand that. But when we go back, let's have fans actually standing up to the train companies and saying, no, let's have proper trains times back. Let us have proper kickoff times back. Let's have proper costs back. You've got a club, and I probably don't need to tell you this, which is actually pretty engaged with the supporters. I know Paul Barber, and he's a decent guy. Graham Potter's, you know, they're people with their hearts in the right places. But next season, I think it's going to be a tricky one for fans, because these owners, and I know, Tony, you've got a very good owner, but owners certainly of certain other clubs, they're going to want to recoup their losses, and fans have got to stand firm. So, look, that's my only rant of the night, is that you, with your platforms that you've got, social media, podcasts, you just want to stand up and make a point.
Do you think there's a danger, though? I mean, particularly in terms of the broadcasters. I mean, we say this on a regular show, that football isn't a TV show. And basically, unfortunately, for the vast majority, that's pretty much what it's having to be at the moment. But I mean, with the changing kickoff times and the fact that there is a danger that the broadcasters will want to stick to those.
I talk to a lot of broadcasters occasionally for some reason when they're desperate for someone to fill in. I go down to the sidelines before the game and just sort of do the overseas broadcasters, obviously I know the home broadcasters. And if you talk to them, particularly the overseas broadcasters, one of the reasons why, like BeIN Sport have just forked out a huge amount of money to continue their rights, one of the reasons they do is because of you. It's because of the backdrop that you provide. It is because of the noise. It is because of the dynamic between the fans. And I wrote a book a few years ago, which did terribly, but I had great fun doing it. And one of the things I did was I sat in a bar in Santa Monica at 6 o'clock in the morning and watched six games back to back. And the fans who were in there, obviously a lot of expats, but a lot of the Americans were watching it, and they were just absolutely smitten by the audience, by the backdrop, by the noise that you make, by the flags, the whole history and colour and emotion. And fans should have a part of that. Fans should, you know, the broadcasters pay for you. And what do you get in return? Inflated ticket prices.
Mm. I mean, this is the supreme irony, isn't it? When you've got the Premier League and the broadcasters getting together, and one of the classic examples is, and we've been in the same division a few times over the past 10 years. The example I give is Brighton and Newcastle. And so rarely is that game kickoff on Saturday at 3 o'clock, whether it's Newcastle, Brighton or Brighton, Newcastle. And their attitude is, well, they're so far away. Brighton fans won't travel up. Newcastle fans won't travel down. So let's put it out there. And you think, hang on a minute, what you're actually doing here is you're taking away, or you're trying to prevent the one thing that you're trying to sell. You're trying to sell a full stadium, or trying to present a full stadium. And in putting the game on Monday night, when only Northern Brighton fans could attend, or London-based Newcastle fans could attend down here, you're actually sort of like emptying the seats up there. There is a twisted logic sometimes to how the broadcasters approach the Premier League, and certainly with, when it comes to the fans. Now, the Premier League themselves may or may not have the fans at heart. Unlikely. Some clubs do, but the broadcasters don't. And it's about time that actually, frankly, and I include, say, the sports safety ground boards here, that fans should actually get involved far more in them as well. Down here, it's a council run thing. I think it's probably across the board. It's a council run thing with ambulances, the NHS, the club, and all the relevant bodies all involved there. But the one set of people who aren't involved in this, in the fans, hang on, we're the ones that are being COVID tested. We're the ones that are actually being asked to do this, that, and the other. You know, and AD, I'd say this to you, and I've ranted about this on the show before. Mm-hmm. We must be involved. I guess that probably, Henry, at every level, you know, there is no reason why fans shouldn't be involved.
There should be a fan on the FA board. There should be a fan on the Premier League board. I think there should be a fan on the board of most clubs. You would hope that, look, Tony Bloom is clearly a fan. Paul Barber is, you know, he's, you know, I had him in the press team and he was a very diligent midfielder and he loves him. You know, he loves that when he was at the FA and he loves the game.
Well, he can actually play football.
Well, don't forget, he was the Renf manager, AD. For three years, he was the Renf manager.
Like this is breaking news here. What sort of a player is Paul Barber?
Well, he bought the kit, so we had to be nice to him.
It wasn't mustard, was it?
No. It was an England one, and I can remember sort of playing in a couple of tournaments with him. And look, this is the England press team here. You know, you've got never was it like me and Paul Hayward, actually, including we would normally have a few ex-pros who would come in and sit in the centre circle and ping the ball around. I remember Mark Lawrenson talking of Brighton legends going back a few years. He would sit in the centre circle and just run the game with his passing. I mean, it was great. And he would always pass a ball and to one of our forwards who'd be puffing away and the ball would be absolutely perfect, but would be about sort of 10, 15 yards ahead of them. And they would turn around and look at Loro and go, you know, can I have it a bit more to my feet? And he said, oh, sorry, I'm used to sort of Ian Rush and people who could run a bit. So what was Paul Barber like? Paul was decent. I mean, the thing that struck me, Paul, is about how, you know, you can tell the charlatans in this game pretty quickly. And Paul Barber loves the game with a passion, loves playing. I think, doesn't he coach? I think, does he coach?
Well, like I say, I mean, I was just saying, Henry, that there's a charity game. Pre-COVID, there's a charity game that takes place at the end of every season. Brighton fans against Crystal Palace fans in the name of an Albion fan who died in the 9/11 attacks. And for about 3 years, he took over the management of the Brighton side. You know, we had these charity games at Lewis. It was great fun. And he really sort of like, you know, he was a kid in a sweet shop. He really had a good time.
Was that at the Dripping Pan?
Yes.
Yeah, it was, yeah.
I'll tell you what, Paul Hayward has to write the story of the Dripping Pan. He's absolutely made for that. Whenever I see Paul Hayward, he's always mentioned he's just been down to the Dripping Pan, even just to look at the pylons or whatever.
Just to say it.
Yeah, just to say it, absolutely. Yeah.
We call it the Pan Zero, but you know what I mean? Okay, well, let's move it on to stuff that's actually on the pitch then. Now, Brighton have been getting all sorts of plaudits for their style of play. Graham Potter is a very intelligent, articulate man, and there was a wonderful interview with him actually recently on Five Live, wasn't
there? Frozen Snot one.
We are getting a little bit itchy with because obviously you can have the most beautiful style of play in the world, but we're not scoring enough goals, and we're sleepwalking our way into the bottom three at the moment. So, I mean, from a neutral's point of view, what is the perception of Brighton at the moment?
I wouldn't have said you're sleepwalking your way. I think you're sort of passing quite elegantly your way, and you've got to be aware of that. I mean, this is a brutal division. You've seen how West Brom, on the back of a decent performance, with all the players still behind Slaven Bilic, have pulled the trigger. They've got Sam Allardyce in. I mean, clearly your problem whenever I look at you is goals. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm a huge Danny Welbeck fan. I've followed his career from the very start. I've interviewed him a few times down the years. And leaving aside that he's a really intelligent, lovely guy who focuses. I remember when he had one of his bad injuries, he was out for about a year. And I talked to him towards the end of it. And he just said, he was doing all the right things in terms of eating. He's not a drinker. He was reading all the sort of the sporting self-help books, strengthening him mentally. He does everything to come back. If there's anyone in this game who deserves a run of games and just for the gods of injury to smile on him for once, it's Danny Welbeck. I can't work out when I look at your strikers, what's the best mix? Whether you play Welbeck on his own with the Lallana behind him, which is Lallana's better position, whether you play Neil Mopé, whether you play Connolly, you see them far more regularly than I do. But that's your problem, the balance of your strikers. If you actually took the best elements, qualities of all your strikers, you'd have one outstanding player. It's just a question of getting that balance right. Is Potter the man to do that? Clearly, it's the man to do that. I was unimpressed when Chris Hughton got sacked, and all the Brighton fans quite rightly pointed out, okay, we stayed up, but the football wasn't good enough. And I got, I had, put it this way, I had an exchange of words with your board. I think it's probably the most diplomatic way of saying it. And my issue was, having been at that final game when you stayed up and we're trying to do my match report with half naked players sort of bouncing around in front of me, because it was the first time the players have invaded a press box. And it was brilliant, and the whole place was parting, and it was a great occasion for Brighton. I just thought Chris Hughton deserved maybe a couple of days of grace to just to enjoy the moment. And then if you're going to get a rid of a manager, do it in the summer, all fair and love and war and management. And I think a manager understands that. But I remember writing at the time, look, it's, I don't agree with the decision, but if they get Potter in, I think you've been heavily linked with him, then look, he's ready to make his mark at the highest level. And I think I like watching you. I don't see a team that's playing with fear. I just see a team that's playing without goals.
Henry, you said, and I've got to take you up on this, because I think it probably did upset a few Brighton fans. You used the word, you accused the Brighton board of cowardice. Do you stand by that?
Yeah, I do. I mean, nothing completely unrelated to how Graham Potter's working out. And I think he's one of the first people I rang in lockdown. I got a nice view over his shoulder looking out onto, I think he lives in Hove. I think he's got a lot of the people live there, and it's a magnificent area to live. I think Chris Hughton's still got a flat down there, actually. Anyway, so it's a lovely
problem. Everyone stays here. Once they come down here, they stay here.
Yeah. Well, look, I mean, my grandmother lived in Worthing, so I used to love going down there. And I mean, it's a beautiful part of the world. Anyway, so in terms of Chris Hughton, absolutely. I thought it was a very un-Brighton thing to do. I thought, just in terms of the timing of it, I just thought, just allow him 2-3 days just to enjoy the moment. But then, of course, the messages that I got back, not from fans. I mean, I get stick from all fans, actually. I think you've got some of the more civilized fans. I just thought, just let him enjoy the moment. But then I was told, well, hang on a sec, we're preparing for next season. Wouldn't it have been more cowardly, I think someone used, to actually invite him into the training ground and have 2 days talking about transfer signings for next season, which the board knew he was never going to be allowed to push through. So, and absolutely, I stand by. I just thought it was a very un-Brighton thing to do. And I know Tony, and he's a genuine fan. I mean, you know, count your blessings that you've got someone there, A, who's wealthy, and B, loves the club and loves football. Because I talked to a lot of fans of a lot of other clubs, and they would absolutely love for their version of Tony. So, yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, if the board were unhappy with what I wrote, but I stand by it, because I think Chris Hughton is, I just thought he deserved 48 hours just to cherish the moment a little bit, rather than bang. Was it the next day he went?
It was very next morning, 7 o'clock in the morning.
Were you guys happy with that? Do you think that was the way a club should behave?
Personally, I agree with the decision, not the way it was done. Like you say, give him a couple of days, maybe go for, you know, mutual agreement or something like that. I think that Tony, as I understood it, had made his mind up about 4 or 5 games beforehand. I think wiser heads on the board suggested, hang on a minute, you know, there's no advantage to be gained in actually offloading the manager with 4 games to go. Mm. Look at what happened with Chris Hughton's Norwich. Look at what happens with so-and-so. So I think there is an element of, yes, it was the right decision. It was done possibly in terms of PR, certainly, in terms of probably how Chris Hughton feels, a little bit clumsily.
I'll tell you what, Al, if I can come in on that one, because the way I kind of felt about that was, we'd spent 5 or 6 games probably moaning on the show. North Stand chat was full of Hughton out, Twitter was in meltdown, all of that sort of stuff. So it wasn't exactly a surprise. But I was working up in Lancashire that week, so I was on the 7 o'clock from Euston up to Preston, and my phone started going mad. And I was getting texts initially from Darren Mackay, who runs NSC, and then from the other guy who moderated it, saying Hughton's gone. And my boss was sat opposite me, and she said, what's happened? Is something going wrong at home? Because I was so surprised. Even though we'd been banging on about it for weeks and weeks and weeks.
We had stunk the place out, hadn't we? The last dozen games.
Yeah. We'd stunk the place out, but still we'd survived. And I think I was still tossing a coin between giving Chris another go because he managed to somehow scrape us.
I'm
staying in the league.
Somehow got over the line. But I mean, it was. The problem is, Chris Hughton's got this reputation as being, you know, the nicest man in football, etc. And anything like that happens to him, it's the football.
It's like kicking a puppy, isn't it?
Can I call you out on that? I don't think he is the nicest man in football. I tell you what, I have crossed him. I got one of the best hair dryers from Chris Hughton.
Really?
Yeah. When I did an interview with someone I shouldn't have done, and he came into the room, and it was slightly an unexpected bollocking because it was from Chris, but absolutely, it's hard as nails. I mean, sorry, you don't have someone who has grown up in the era that he did, at the time that he did, who played football in the era that he did, and come to the top and then last so long as a coach without being tough. So this nice guy thinks nonsense.
I don't think you'll come across a single Brighton fan that hasn't got the best words to say about Chris. I mean, his reputation and is still intact, and he was such a wonderful person. He brought the zeitgeist of the club, of the city, and everything else. And you know, he was absolutely wonderful. Was the time right for a change? Yes, it was. But yeah, like you said, the method of the dispatch could have done with a little bit more thought.
Henry, I've got to say this: there is, as you kind of pointed out, there is a culture at the club there where, you know, you've got the people at the top have an attitude towards football and towards football fans in ways that other clubs don't have. And I think the issue here is that Chris Hughton very, very quickly bought into, I mean, it sounds really sort of arrogant and snobbish to say we've got this culture, but, you know, we do know, and we are, you know, we do recognise our blessings of having Tony Bloom at the top and two excellent football administrators in Dan Ashworth and Paul Barber also helping Tony. Tony's clever enough to know what he doesn't know. And so I think that, you know, Chris Hughton was that perfect fit at the same time. So I think that probably the Chris Hughton that you knew versus the Chris Hughton that we knew, I mean, obviously we didn't know that sort of like hairdryer treatment side of him, as AD says, I think is absolutely correct that he will actually command a place should anyone ever build a Brighton and Hove Albion Parthenon.
Here's a quick question for the three of you. Would you rather boring football in the Premier League or free-flowing Brazil 1970 in the Championship?
Jason Thackeray.
I would prefer Brazil 1970 in the Championship. That'd be absolutely brilliant. But of course, if it's successful, you just end up with boring football in the Premier League again the next season because you can't.
Alan?
It'd be lovely for a season because it is very monotonous. I mean, for all the lovely football we're playing, we're still 16th and we're still having our backs to the wall occasionally. We're still getting shut out occasionally.
Yeah. In answer to that question, I would say that I have faith in Graham Potter that we can have the best of both worlds. We can play some free-flowing football. I personally think that the issue that Graham Potter needs is an increase and improvement in quality of the staff that he's got. And bit by bit by bit, I mean, certainly we've improved in terms of quality on the pitch from last season. But this time around, you know, it is frustrating that we're leaving so many points on the pitch and the forward line is obviously getting the pelters that sometimes it obviously deserves. But I honestly believe that we have it within ourselves. And if Tony is able to back Graham in the way that he wants to, I believe that we can have the best of both worlds of having some good free-flowing football in the Premier League.
That doesn't mean now that Graham's averse to any sort of criticism.
Of course not.
But at the end of the day, I mean, no club has got any divine right to success. And, you know, if things did go horribly wrong this season, then I dare say it would probably be because, again, we haven't been putting the ball in the back of the net. But yes, I mean, Graham he's largely getting it right. There are issues that need to be addressed.
It's still a lot more exciting to watch than those last few games under Chris Hughton. And I say with Chris Hughton, it was the direction of travel that worried us all. I appreciate your point, Jason, about, you know, tossing a coin to give him another year. But you know, it seemed to be that direction of travel of dourness, of defensiveness, of not losing was actually becoming our undoing. And when it didn't work, Bournemouth 5-0 at home, Cardiff, Southampton, those three games that I think were that marked the final death knell for Chris Hughton, were the ones that you think, well, hang on, these are the games that we're expecting points from, rather than Arsenal, rather than Man City, rather than Chelsea. These are the ones we expect, and we didn't, you know, and we were lucky to get nil in each case.
Okay. Yeah, well, I think that was my point, though, Al. I think I expected him to go after Cardiff because we were so woeful.
Well, I think that's the moment that Tony decided that he's got to go, and I think probably wiser heads assumed, you know, sort of said, oh, hang on, like I said, there's nothing to be gained. Ironically, you know, look, you look back on it, it's actually Crystal Palace that we should be thanking for beating Cardiff. Yeah, the irony's not lost on me.
Yeah, I know. I remember that game very, very well. Okay, but let's look to the positives. I mean, basically, I mean, with the things, we're not in the bottom three. We've only been in the bottom three once since we got promoted back to the league 4 years ago. And, you know, we've got a chance to put that right again and get ourselves moving in the right direction. We've got, well, the game on Sunday, isn't it? It's the world.
Banana skin and a half.
Worst
that
home
is,
side against the league's worst away side. So, I mean, I'm not saying it's got 0-0 written all over it, Henry, but I mean, it's not one that's setting the pulses racing.
Sheffield United.
Yeah.
You just think at some point Sheffield United are going to click because they've got a good manager. You looked at them for periods. Was it last night, the Manchester United game? It's all blur at the moment. Yeah, I mean, there were moments in that game. You would think at some point Rin Brewster will click and get going. There's goals in him. It was interesting looking at some of his tweets earlier today. There's someone who is really wanting a point to prove. Whether you'll take it out, your defence, I don't know. I mean, it's interesting looking at Brighton, as I say, from afar, and I'm, you know, I don't go regularly to games, only about sort of three or four a season at the Amex. But I want to know what's going on in your goal. Because I've seen a couple of, maybe it's because I see Matt Ryan in highlights and I think, oh, actually, he's quite decent. But then actually talking to some Brighton fans and going on the Brighton forums, they've said, you're saying he hasn't been so great for a bit. This is a huge call. I mean, listening to Potter in his press conference earlier today about, was Ryan going to leave? Is Sanchez now established in goal? You know, you can talk about the strikers, but you've got to get that goalkeeping situation sorted out. Do the three of you believe that Sanchez is the right choice?
I mean, at the beginning of the season, when we went into the pre-season game against Chelsea, which was the test event where fans were allowed back in. 2,500 went very, very well.
Great success, yeah,
absolutely.
And, but yeah, I mean, in that game, the heir apparent to Matt Ryan was going to be Christian Walton. You know, he's been at the club for a very, very long time. He's perennially out on loan, getting his experience. I mean, he made his debut for us away at Spurs, of all places, but when we were in
4 years ago, 5 years ago, yeah.
Yeah, and but you know, and we thought that he might be ready then, but the I mean, Ben Roberts is one of the most renowned goalkeeping coaches in the industry, and what he's done for several of our goalkeepers has been outstanding. But then Christian's come back from a brilliant loan spell at Blackburn last year. And he came on as a substitute in half-time in that game and landed awkwardly and went off injured and very little of him's been seen ever since. So Rob Sanchez has come into the...
Don't forget, he's overtaken Jason Steele as well. I mean, Rob Sanchez was actually the fourth choice keeper at the club. So if Walton's not ready, because he's been playing for the under-23s and Jason Steele is there and thereabouts, it's a slightly unusual choice, I must admit. But he's played two games, hasn't really dropped any rickets. The two goals he conceded against Spurs earlier this season weren't really down to him. At the moment, we've got no problem with him. But then I think that probably most people who are coached by Ben Roberts, you know, I think that they are certainly better than anything that we need fear.
He's also got some good experience. Well, experience. He's got some good centre-halves in front of him.
Yeah.
Yeah. Jason? I think Sanchez has got what Ryan doesn't. He's physically commanding. He's got a physical presence. Mm. Ryan, and then there's a running joke on North Stand chat about him being too small, convinced by Ryan when the set pieces are coming in. He lets the centre-halves deal with it all the time.
Yeah. There are times when there seems to be communication issues as well. But I mean, I
think you two are being a bit harsh, actually. I think you are.
None of us have got a problem with Matty Ryan now. I mean, if you know, he's very rarely missed a game for us. But I mean, Potter said his omission on Wednesday night was tactical.
There's a euphemism.
Yeah, think it might have been a little bit of that. But yeah, I mean, Sanchez is obviously he's a taller guy. He's more commanding in his box. We've had issues conceding goals from set pieces this year. And mate is part of that for part down to the fact that the goalkeeper isn't as demanding.
I think we're going to need a run of games before we decide whether it was actually Matt Ryan was the issue or not, or whether there is something, you know, whether the issues you talk about, communication, height, commanding of the box, et cetera, et cetera. You can't really tell even after two games, and even two games which have been, you know, a month apart. You're going to have, if Sanchez is going to be in goal, let's say even just over the Christmas period, that's when you can judge him over about half a dozen games. So far, it's a little bit harsh to say whether he's going to be, you know, good enough or not. I mean, one of the criticisms that people have of Matty Ryan is that he doesn't make enough saves. And I'm thinking, well, I mean, you know, Sanchez made one save against Fulham. And you think, well, are you actually expecting a big long litany of saves that to make against him? In which case, if you are, then you need to have a word with your defensive line. So
it was actually a couple more of them.
But
one of the issues with that, I think that Graham Potter might possibly be having with Matty is because a few of the opposition sides have actually been targeting him, particularly at corners where they're basically piling the ball's been directly straight in at Matt Ryan.
Burnley did that.
Yeah, Burnley did that. Everton did that. It was. It's become a tactic against us, very much like you know, opposition. They're going to be looking for weak points, and for some reason, that is something that they perceive to be one. And Potter's trying to solve the problem. Now, Matty will come back stronger than this. He's a confident guy. I mean, have you ever met an unconfident Australian? Let's face it. But it's.
Did you see the tweet where Andy Naylor said Sanchez is staying in for Sheffield United? Because if ever they decide you need a physical presence in the box against, it's Sheffield United.
Yes. Yeah. No, fair enough. You know,
but as Alan says, he needs a run. If you're going to give someone a run, you give him Sheffield United. What has he then got? West Ham, Arsenal, Wolves, Newport in the Cup.
Yeah.
So is that your run?
Yeah.
I mean, that's what we've got for Christmas, yeah. Yeah. You can't, I mean, even then it might be Jason Steele in the Cup. But if you're going to give Sanchez a run, then yes, give him a run.
Be wary of Newport. I watched them against Newcastle early in the season, and they really pushed Newcastle all the way. I think it went to penalties in the end. I think
absolutely. Well, of all people that's going to know Newport County is Ben White, so I think we're going to be.
Yeah, he won't be playing. He'll be he'll be on his way to Liverpool by then, probably. But
yeah.
Okay, you are listening to the Albion Raw here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. This show, as ever, is brought to you in association with the fabulous oldfootballshirts.com. And Phil has tried to kill me this week.
I love you and I hate you, Phil, because this is hilarious.
But Phil, I mean, we know I fall over. We know I can fall over my words from time to time,
especially in the English
foreign
ones,
foreign languages. But oh my God! But I'm going to give this a red hot go. But Henry, you've had a look at this shirt. Can you just before you let us know who you think it is? Can you just describe it for us?
Impossible, really. It is. how would you describe it? I mean, I think if you rave in the early 80s, it might come into focus.
Okay.
It looks like it's been made out of the leggings that are worn by the ladies that do yoga on Hove Seafront when they're social distance.
Jason, give us an idea at least of the colour here, mate.
It's, black with purple triangles formed into a diagonal pattern. It looks.
I think the best
in mind of a Pink Floyd album, actually. More than
I think the
rave.
Best way of describing this one, Jason, if you think about the Arsenal Bruce Banana shirt, but in red and black instead, but with a massive NHS across the front of it.
There's also some watermarked, as well as the badge, there's also some watermarked words. Jason, can you read what those watermarked words are?
Not NHS, then.
No, the ones across the black.
I'll tell you what, I'll let AD do it.
Yeah, okay.
Do you want me to have a go?
Go for it, Henry. Come on, Henry.
I have to say, I've actually been there because it's in the north of Wales, if I remember. Flan Rhea, Pwyl Gwyn Gil, Go Geri, Go Go Goch. And I missed out about half a mile in the middle.
You did, yeah, actually.
You did. That was a good effort, though.
It was a good effort.
It's definitely Flan Rhea.
But you are correct. Gwyn, this is the 2020 to 2021 home shirt of Welsh Anglesey League side. Lanver Pwyl Gwyn, Gel Go Gwech, Wyn Drobel Lan, Torsillo, go, go, go.
Did Can you imagine how unpopular you would be if you were the fan there who went, give us an L?
Did your nearly Welsh better half help you with that, AD?
No, she's not seen it yet. But this is what Phil has to say about the Llanfair Pwyl Gwyn Gwel Gogerech Wyn Drobel Lan Torsillo, go, go, go. They're normally shortened to Lanferwy. The shirt proudly honours the NHS workers in regards to the COVID pandemic. Lanferwy are formed in 1899 and they play at the 1,000 capacity Maes Elian, which translates to Elian's Field, on the outskirts of the town on the Isle of Anglesey. St. Elian was a 6th century saint who was sent from Rome by the Pope to become the missionary to Cadwallon, who was the ruler of Anglesey. They played as high as the second tier of Welsh football, the Cymru North, and when most recently they were promoted to the Welsh Alliance Division 1 in 2001. Since then, they've stuck around the Welsh Alliance Leagues until last season when relegation took them into the Anglesey League. They've played league opposition once in the competitive game. Shrewsbury Town were the visitors in 1987 in the Welsh Cup and they lost 1-0. Current squad members include Az and Big D at centre-half, Bamboo at right-back, Elmo in midfield. I kid you not, this is how they are named on the official website. And their all-time top player. Now, there's a question. This information was provided by Steve Smith, who does their Facebook page. Mark Lloyd Williams played for Llanfairwy at the beginning of his career and then went on to become the Welsh Premier League all-time top goal scorer and still is. And he played for in League Two for Stockport and York, made 576 appearances for a couple of dozen sides.
Phil does love his non-league football,
yeah,
doesn't he?
Yeah, it's a bit obscure stats. But yeah, thanks for that, Phil. And Merry Christmas to you too, mate. And this shirt and many others. Over 110,000 on oldfootballshirts.com. And
AD, whenever I think of Welsh football, I always think of, you know the kind of the thing of Bill McLaren. Oh, they'll be dancing in the streets of Total Network Solutions tonight. That kind of thing.
If I can just intervene, I love Welsh football, but when the FA Cup was being played down at the Millennium, we took on the Welsh press the night before. We get down there early, play the Welsh press, raising money for a local hospice, and then have a night out with the Welsh boys. And I rang up my counterpart, I think on the South Wales Echo, wherever it was, and said to him, I said, listen, I am bringing down 12, 13 English journalists, never played the game before in their life. You know, all journalists just want to check that yours is a bona fide media team. And the reply I got back, absolutely no problem. Yeah, they're all working in Welsh media. We played at Ninian Park the first game. Mm-hmm. And as we came out of the England, the away dressing room in an England kit that we borrowed probably off Paul Barber, the first one out of the home dressing room, the Welsh media dressing room, was Mark Hughes. The second one out was Neville Southall. The third one out was Kevin Ratcliffe. The fourth one out was the much missed Stuart Cable, who was the drummer of the Stereophonics, who was a really decent player. The fifth or the sixth one out was Joe Calzaghe. And I was standing there looking at them and saying, I think Ian Rush was playing as well. And I said to Mark Hughes, I said, just because I know Sparky. And I said to him, what are you doing working in the media? He said, oh, I'm doing sort of Dragon FM tonight or whatever. So, and they absolutely took us to the cleaners. And there were about 4,000 or 5,000 Welsh fans in there who absolutely loved it. So, it was fantastic. Good. Love going and playing down there. Love going to games down there. Good place.
No, the thing is, when you're probably doing Welsh non-league there as well, there's a high probability that the setting is actually going to be idyllic.
Yeah. I mean, the one in Anglesey. I mean, I've been up to Anglesey. I mean, it's stunning up there. So I'm going to have to go and can I bid for that shirt? Which looks like, I have to say, I think the best description of it is probably, it looks like it's been reversed over by a very heavy truck.
Yes.
Because it's got tyre marks all at your friendly front flare Pringle, go.
We'll put you in touch with Phil and we'll see, because what it is that everyone can take a photo of their own shirt, so it's not owned by Phil on the site. It's the individual person. But if right. If there's a, actually, I think it's next year's shirt. Did you say 2021? So it's this year's
shirt. It's the current one. But yeah, Phil's just taking delivery of that this week, so it's shirt. But of course, Wales is a big rugby country. And one of the rules which they have in rugby, the concussion substitutes, and that looks like something that's going to be coming into the Premier League as of January, hopefully. It's a long, long time coming, isn't it, Henry?
I mean, it's ridiculous. It's taken so long. I can remember being in the World Cup final in 2014 in Rio when one of the German players, a young midfielder, got basically knocked out after about 20 minutes. And Kramer, I think it was, and he played on for about 13, 14 minutes. And during that time, he went up to the referee and basically said, "Where am I? Is this the World Cup final?" So he quite rightly eventually got taken on, but he played on for about 14, 15 minutes. So I think after that, FIFA said, "Listen, we've got to do something about it. We need concussion subs." And it's taken them this long. So it's not even a debate. You know, the squads are big enough. You can have them on there. I think what you do is you bring the concussion substitute on. The player, whoever it is, David Luiz or whoever, goes down the tunnel, gets inspected by an independent doctor. And then, you know, there isn't that hurry to sort of bring him back on to play, to keep the numbers up to 11. Because you know what players are like. The players will say, "I'm fine. I absolutely want to play." Decisions should be taken out of their hands. Concussion substitute brought on, an independent doctor look at the player, and then if he's fine, you know, send him back on. But it's crazy that it's taken so long to bring this in. But, and you know, everyone's saying, well, it's because of the focus on dementia, the impact of heading the ball, collision. Absolutely, you know, there's a huge issue that are being debated at the moment. But actually, concussion and concussion substitutes were a huge debate 6-7 years ago.
Hang on, AD, is it, are you saying that what this concussion substitution is, it's not a sort of third, fourth, fifth substitute that you can have to permanently replace the player? It's just those few minutes while the player is... So it's effectively a rolling substitute that they can come back on and off. Is that how it's going to work? Like in rugby, is that how it's going to work?
Well, it depends. It depends on what the situation is, I think, Henry, doesn't it? I mean, in regard, I think from the way I've read it, it can be a permanent substitute if the player is unable to continue, and this can happen if you've made your three subs and there's a concussion incident in, say, for instance, the 75th minute, then you can actually, then you would be able to make that change if it was deemed necessary by the official.
Is that what we're saying is happening?
That's what it's. I think we can pretty much say it's definitely going to happen. Yeah.
Well, I would go with 80. To be honest, I've read the wording of it, and actually, it's not completely clear. So, if you've had three substitutes, can you then effectively bring a fourth on? Because what we don't want is it to be used like rugby did with Bloodgate, and you actually sort of deliberately use it to make a tactic. You don't want this used tactically. Clearly, for a player to have some concussion issue, it would require a certain amount of subterfuge, even by football standards, to actually sort of make a fake change there. So, look, I've got to study it a little bit more. I'm just still flabbergasted it's taken so long for IFAB to come around to it.
Particularly when it, like I mentioned rugby there, but it's not just rugby. I mean, like well, they've already got the rule in the A-League in Australia, Aussie rules, etc. They've got in cricket as well. If you get hit, and it's been pretty much every other sport.
To one of the things that are actually in other sports here, this is something that's come up bone of contentious. And again, Henry, yes, we will get onto VAR in a minute, Jason. But again, something else, Henry, is that, and we've been kind of on the receiving end of this, is there is a kind of a red card, I believe, rule in rugby about when two players go up for the ball and one just ducks down, meaning he's used effectively as a hurdle for the other player to go crashing over him. Now, Lallana did that. He went crashing over Harry Kane outside the area, got a penalty given against us. And I see this as a particularly dangerous thing to do, where a player is actually bending themselves, knowing full well that there's a player is about to go over the top of them and could land on their head. Is this actually something that's got onto your radar at all?
Not in terms of a law change, because I don't see how you can do it. I think there's been focuses on certain individuals, particularly strikers, who do it, make a back so that the a player can go over the top of them and land awkwardly. I mean, what you're seeing, I mean, I think, is it called spearing in rugby? Where, but that's actually when you're sort of holding someone and you're driving them down, and there's a grey area kind of there. Are you actually dropping them? Have you got your hands on them? I mean, again, but actually, I look at the, I'm not a huge fan of rugby. But whenever I watch the rugby, the standard of officiating actually seems pretty high. Certainly compared to, maybe it's because I'm only watching international rugby and the standards, obviously, the officiating is going to be even higher. But I just think generally we have a, and this will lead into Jason's favourite subject of VAR, that I think we have an issue with the standard of refereeing in this country. And having done this for 35, 36 years, covering football, I think this is one of the poorest collections of referees I've seen. I think they've also been undermined and had their any confidence they might have had, I think they've had that taken away by technology as well.
So moving on in that case to the VAR argument. Now, Jason, you've been on the show a few times. You know, when it was coming in, we didn't know what form it was going to take, and then it was in the World Cup and what have you. You were hardly its greatest advocate. So 2 years down the line, how are you feeling about it now?
You told me not to swear, Al.
Okay.
I mean, no, I've got a very, very simple view on it. And it goes back to what Henry was saying at the start about, you know, treating fans, because the fans are the lifeblood of the game. They're the background of the game. And it has removed the biggest reason to go to football. That moment of joy when you score a goal, particularly late on, or particularly when it changes the winning position in the game. And you see a whole, you know, that Lewis Dunk at Fulham, the entire stand went limbs crazy.
2 years ago, brilliant, people. Yeah. 4 years ago.
Absolutely brilliant. That moment is going. And, you know, when we scored against Fulham, I say scored in inverted commas, against Fulham, me and my son didn't even bother celebrating. We just went, that's going to get chalked off by VAR. And lo and behold, it was. I mean, it rightly.
That one was actually correct, though, Jay.
It was correct, yeah. But the point was, neither of us jumped off the sofa and went, yes, get in there, 1-0.
I mean, credit where the credit's due. I thought I don't actually know who the ref was on
Rob Lewis.
He
was only his
probably the best we've had this season. And I don't dispute that call. It's the fans again are being robbed of a moment that used to be so pivotal to watching football.
Yeah. But that aside, Jason, I mean, you know, there's that aspect to it, the fans thing, but with the nature of how VAR is being used and how it's interpreted and what do you and the Albion have been the beneficiaries and on the receiving end of its decisions. Do you feel it actually has a purpose, or do you feel that actually you'd rather go back to the days of human error and, you know, the referee making a whoopsie and that's just part of the game?
I'd rather go back to the referee making a whoopsie, but if you're going to use the technology, at least have some consistency in its application, because I don't understand right now when they go to VAR, whether it is a clear and obvious decision, what they're making that decision based on. The Southampton penalty was the killer for me. I mean, yes, it's obviously a foul, but
okay. Well, let's just bring Henry in.
Is there an error to give it a penalty?
Yeah, Henry. I mean, are you familiar with this incident?
Yeah. So, look, I've unfortunately, it's probably taken up about 20% of my week. VAR for the last sort of couple of years. I mean, I was in Paris in 2009 when Thierry Henry handled the ball on against the Irish, and William Gallas scored, and the Irish were denied the possibility of a place in the World Cup. And there were elements like that, and the hand of God. And, you know, if it's clear and obvious, if it's a major travesty, which everyone can see very quickly, i.e. clear and obvious, then technology has its place. And I was a supporter of it when it came in, as long as it didn't involve schoolmasters in Stockley Park getting their rulers out, getting their compasses out, and almost, as Jason so eloquently put it, and you know, your fans, just taking away the joy. You're not only taking away the joy from supporters, as you say, the great sort of limbs moments of everyone going crazy, that immediate outpouring of joy, you're taking away the joy from some of the players because they immediately look up to see, is there VAR in progress? You actually, I have to say, look, journalists should be far down the pecking order in terms of, you know, what we think of what's going on inside grounds. But actually, I have to say, VAR, I just think it's just taking away the joy of covering a game, the joy of supporting the game, and for the players, clearly, for an element, the joy of actually playing the game. The more players I talk to, the less enthusiasm there is for VAR, partly because they've been on the receiving end, but partly because they're saying, well, actually, do you know what, mate? It's not that much fun standing around for 3 minutes in the cold, waiting for a schoolmaster in Stockley Park to get his ruler and his lines in the right order. I don't think, to be honest, I think they should have brought this in and said, leave the power with the individual in the middle. If there is a feeling that he's made an absolute howler, maybe whatever that is, once a game, every other game, whatever, then have a word. But seriously, if we're talking about, because you see, everyone says, well, it's not been helped by the law changes, handball and offside. Those have all been brought in because VAR and David Ellery and everyone at Stockley Park are micro-refereeing the game. So they're having to change the law to actually decide whether an armpit's onside or not. So I think it's just being used too much. Let's use it for clear and obvious, for Thierry Henry's handball, for Diego Maradona's handball, and then let the game flow. If they're mistakes, look, everyone will probably accept that, particularly now having had this trial by VAR, but also invest in the quality of officials in this country at all level. Sort out some of the dissent and the abuse that referees, officials get at parks level, in non-league. Help them, invest in them, maybe get one or two more players involved, and then the game will improve.
Yeah. I mean, I just don't get... I mean, what I would like to see happen is the power being given back to the on-field officials. So let the linesman be the linesman, let the referee be the referee, and you can still have someone watching the game at Stockley Park, but you know, no one's interested. If someone's like a left testicle offside, I don't care. That's onside. Give the advantage to the attacker. That's fine. That's the way it's always been. Like you said, only if it's a glaring error. If it's a blatant dive, then fine. Okay, that was a dive. Let the on-field referee, and then only contact them if there's a glaring error.
Jason, is there anything that because obviously, you know, being a concerned critic is probably the most sort of diplomatic way I could put it. A concerned critic of VAR before it came in. Now that we've got it, is there anything that, supposing that it is actually going to stay, and rather than doing away with it completely and let the referee make his howler, is there what that you haven't necessarily heard? Is there anything that you could do that you'd have VAR changed?
I think Henry's hit the nail on the head there, to be honest with you. I mean, it isn't going away. No one's going to put the genie back in the bottle, unfortunately. So let's start using it pretty much exactly as Henry described. Clear and obvious, only once or twice a game. Absolute max. I've never been against technology per se. So the goal line tech, apart from that, probably that one instance where I think it was where it didn't work, Sheffield United, was it?
Sheffield United, and Villa, yeah.
And it was still very costly, but, like, wasn't it?
But you know, clear and obvious and technical.
So do you go along? I mean, I've spent a bit of time thinking about the sort of like the nature of the English referees. I mean, have you particularly noticed a reduction in quality of refereeing? I mean, once upon a time we had Jack Taylor, we had Clive Thomas, we had Roger Milford and his wham wristbands, and we had these characters, and now we don't have them. I mean, they're probably, you know, they're the professionals in their own right. Has taken referees into being full-time professionals changed anything, or is there something inherently wrong at the heart of PG Moll that we're getting such supposedly inferior referees?
Well, look at the last World Cup. No English officials went. So FIFA and UEFA decided no referees in the country that produced the game, codified the game, and is probably the most obsessed, along with Brazil and a couple of other countries in the world. No officials came from this country. I mean, it was just, I know Clattenburg changed, I think he changed jobs and he didn't go. So that was another issue. But absolutely, we need to improve the standards of the officials. We need to invest in them. We need to give them their confidence back. We need to allow them to go out and referee without feeling there's the schoolmaster in Stockley Park who is actually who's overseeing their homework live, effectively. So, look, the game belongs to you. The game belongs to fans. The game belongs to players. It doesn't belong to David Ellery and the schoolmasters at Stockley Park. So get the balance right. Empower the officials actually within the stadium. It shouldn't be decided 200 miles away or whatever. And let's just get the game back and get the joy back. And after a year like this, we need the national game to be as joyous as possible.
If there has been a regression in quality in refereeing then, Henry, or Jason for that matter, if there has been a regression in refereeing, could you say there's an argument for those recently retired referees, those who at the top of the game, say 10, 15 years ago, to be doing the VAR job? It's not as though there's any need for physical exertion. So do you think there might be, if assuming that the referees were better that time ago, is there a case for having them as VAR officials?
If you're asking me, Al, I mean, I'm really not sure. If you, various TV companies now are employing older referees as analysts, and they're making about as much sense as the guys in Stockley Park, to be honest. So I don't think that's really a goer.
Okay, well let's move on. I mean, I think this conversation would be had up and down. Well, it would have been happening in pubs if they were open up and down the country. But it's something I think 99% of football fans, journalists,
yeah, their hair out, AD.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's ridiculous. I mean, it's a stat I use on a regular basis, Al, but I mean, it's the year before VAR came in, 94% of the decisions that were correct. I would take those odds. There is, you know, it wasn't broken, don't fix it. It's no, VAR isn't black and white. It's in the opinion of goal line technology, is it over the line or not? Well, that's a black and white decision. There's too many vagaries involved in it, and it's just not fit for purpose at the moment. Until they can fix it, it's just going to be as frustrating, and they just got to bring back the joy, stop being joy stealers. And it's Christmas time, it's the time of joy and goodwill.
But sadly, that's all we've got time for. Thank you very much indeed to Jason Thackeray. Thank you very much indeed to Henry Winter, who actually at the top of the show only promised 10 minutes and gave us the full hour. Fantastic. Hope you enjoyed the show. Thank you, as the year has gone by, to our continued sponsorship from oldfootballshirts.com. Thanks very much indeed, Phil. Thank you very much for listening in. We've enjoyed your company. We're glad you like the show. If you don't like it, tell us. If you do like it, tell others. But this year, 2020, it's been a funny year. It's been horrid. We've locked down. We've not seen our friends. And to cap it all, there's been an unelected man at the top of the government who has raised everyone's hackles. So we're going to finish off, as we always do at Christmas, with a song about Christmas, about a donkey. But we feel it's more appropriate for 2020 than ever. Have yourselves a great Christmas, and we'll see you on the other side. Cheers for now.
Dominic, Dominic, why are you stalling? Don't you hear love calling to you? Move, move, move your little foot, do. Dominic, Dominic, pick one and take her. There's acres and acres to choose. Oh, oh, only a fool would refuse. I, if I had your trouble, life would be double good sweet. There'd be no grass growing under my feet. Listen, Dominic, Dominic, when will you hunger? You ain't getting younger, my friend. Love, love, love 'em all right to the end. I, I can't understand you leaving them beauties forlorn. It's time to take the old bull by the horn. Come on, Dominic, Dominic, they're itching and twitching. Better start pitching some moo, moo, moo.